Welcome to Ufahamu Africa, a podcast about life and politics on the African continent. I'm Kimmy Dion, one of your hosts, and I'm joined by my co-host, Rachel Beatty-Riedel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Kim, and hello, listeners. So this week, after Kim and I talk about what we're reading and listening to in the news, we have the last but not least series of our African Studies Association panel, where we're joined by Paul Friesen today, who's a postdoctoral associate at Cornell University, and he's able to talk with us about how local level involvement in democracy, in particular engagement between citizens and traditional leaders or members of local councilors, relate to how citizens perceive democracy in terms of their trust and their satisfaction with democracy as a regime, and therefore potentially as a kind of buttress and safeguarding of democratic practice.
Right. I'm really looking forward to our listeners hearing that presentation that Paul had made. I think it's really exciting work that he's doing and of course, like a lot of research that he's building on. For our listeners who haven't heard already, there were protests this week in Kampala, in the capital city of Uganda. And these came after there was what seems like a house arrest or a detainment or the inability for movement of two primary opposition political figures. And that's Bobi Wine, who has served as a member of parliament, but also ran against Yoweri Museveni for the presidency, and also longtime opposition leader Kizza Besigye, also a many times failed opposition candidate for the presidency against Yoweri Museveni, who, as we all know, has held the presidency in Uganda since the 1980s, since before many of our listeners were probably born. So you can read about the protests, which I think are really interesting. The protests were about potholes, right, in the city. So one of the things I love about learning from, you know, everyday people who live in Kampala, Uganda's capital city, is the demands for governance, right? Good governance, right? Public services, you know, let us have good transportation, let us have, you know, good roads. And so one of the creative things that they're doing is if you see a pothole, plant a banana plant in it, right? Like do something that is, you know, it's really interesting. It's this very like eco-conscious thing, right? But also a banana plant, for anyone who's ever seen one, they're quite tall, so you can't miss them. So like maybe you can miss the potholes because you drive in like some military vehicle. And so you don't really feel the bumps like everyone else who's driving maybe a secondhand car from Japan, like a very small Toyota where you feel every little nook and cranny in the road. Right. Not even that, like you could even drive on it, because some of these potholes are quite large. And you can see photos and video. If you go to Bobi Wine's Twitter page, you can see photos and videos that he's uploaded that various people who are participating in these protests have shared with him of the different things they're doing. There's, you know, very satirical photo of three men sitting around a pothole, holding a fishing pole with a fish in it in the water in the pothole, right? So it's quite a sight to be seen. And it's not just Bobi Wine and Kizza Besigye, right? The executive director of UNAIDS, Winnie Byanyima, had posted to Twitter on Thursday morning that the Ugandan police and army, quote, have invaded our home and camped there and are restricting our movement in and out of our farm. More than 20 of them. We lived like this for 5 years. Now they are back. Security forces are act illegally with impunity. It's wrong. It's a shame. Now, of course, later in that same day, she posts a picture of herself, you know, being able to leave. But there's something, you know, there's something palpable there. You know, she's not an opposite. Like she is the executive director of a major multilateral organization, and not having freedom of movement in the country. Now, to understand these protests, I recommend, of course, as always, Africa Uprising by Adam Branch and Zachariah Montpilli, which gives some context to protests in Africa and kind of putting them across these various waves. But they have a chapter devoted to the Walk to Work protests in 2011 in Uganda that I think will also kind of give a sense of what's happening here and Kizza Besigye's role in kind of working with civil society and various activists in the city. I also recommend a recently published book out of Ohio University Press, and that's To Speak and Be Heard by Holly Hansen, which puts citizen demands for effective governance in Uganda in a broader historical context. Now, one more thing I want to say about these pothole protests is that they're coming at the time when Uganda is hosting the summit of the non-aligned movement. Now, this is the 19th summit of the non-aligned movement, which originated in the aftermath of the Korean War. So this is a multilateral grouping that has existed for over 5 decades. And there's people have lots of different ways of characterizing what the non-aligned movement is. But Rachel and I can say, as Gen Xers, you know, who lived through the Cold War, right? This is one of those groupings that was, you know, during the Cold War, it was really a bipolar world where you were with the Americans or you were with the Soviets, right? And so you had these, what countries would do is they would choose sides, except for those countries who were, quote, non-aligned, right? And so that's where the non-aligned movement comes in. And this is, you know, a foreign policy instrument that could promote national security interests of some of its members that would otherwise feel isolated in the international community, where these two states, right, the United States and the USSR, just carried so much weight and had so much influence. And it was, you know, really trying to promote this idea of non-alignment. So 93 of 120 movement nations were represented in Kampala this week when they're having this big, you know, pothole protest in the streets. But for folks who want to learn more about the non-aligned movement, I recommend an article that Marco Vieira had published in International Studies Review a few years ago that helps us understand. I mean, we know the Cold War has been over for decades. So how does the non-aligned movement still exist? Why is it so resilient? In that article, he makes some really compelling arguments about the resilience of these kind of multilateral groupings among non-aligned countries, even if there's not this Cold War bipolar world, there's still, as we know, a lot of dominance by a few kind of heavy hitters in international politics, not least the country, of course, that Rachel and I live in, the United States of America, but others as well.
Kim, it's so interesting, you know, how you mentioned, of course, the kind of stability and the resilience that that these member states have in terms of their shared identity and just in vis-a-vis the very uncertain global order. And I think we see that, you know, kind of with the BRICS level of groupings and through regional organizations like SADC or ECOWAS or, you know, other ways of thinking about like what gives countries a little bit more ability to integrate. And so we see that, you know, European Union and beyond. So really an interesting question in terms of kind of how that might help reify or create a sense of shared identity and goals. So I want to just take up from these pothole protests the idea of citizens and eco-conscious demands and shift to not only how governments might respond to those kinds of demands from citizens, but also the question of how corporate entities, private entities might respond to those kinds of demands around thriving, well-being, healthy environments. And that is with some news that's coming out of, big news coming out of Nigeria around the oil economy, right? So we know Nigeria's relationship with oil has been longstanding and complex. And there are two really interrelated stories, I think, this week that speak to how oil production in Nigeria is changing as we move towards a different future, but building on kind of past legacies. So first and foremost, Africa's first and biggest oil refinery begins production in Nigeria. So it's not Africa's first refinery, but Nigeria's first refinery has begun production this week. And it's through the Dangote Petroleum Refinery. And it's been years long in the making, but of course, it's really an interesting and important development in terms of the whole oil economy, because Nigeria has heretofore been an importer of refined petroleum, right? So this will give the country the ability to produce diesel and aviation fuel and a whole host of things rather than import them. So that's a very interesting kind of the value add chain rather than being just the exporter of the raw materials, but in a context of a really shifting global climate around demand for oil And, you know, looking forward, that this is where Nigeria's corporate sector is kind of making investments is interesting, particularly in light of the second story that we have to share with you today, which is that Shell is selling its onshore Nigeria oil businesses. So they're pulling out of all onshore activity in Nigeria for $1.3 billion they're selling, which have been in the Niger Delta region. And the company stated that the aim was to reduce risk, right? These risks that have been linked to a series of lawsuits over oil spills, over harm to local communities. And so the company is going to continue to produce oil and drill for oil offshore, as well as expand in liquefied gas, but try to reduce risk with the onshore drilling. So interestingly, the buyers of this percentage, 30% of a joint venture, are mostly made up of Nigerian companies. It's a consortium called Renaissance Africa Energy. It's four Nigerian companies and a small international company, and they will take up Shell's 30% in what is a bigger venture. 55% of it is owned by Nigeria's state oil company. So it's really, you know, kind of dominant control by the state oil company. And then France's Total, which we also know has been this long history of questions and concerns and legal complications over spills and harm to local communities. So this is, you know, Shell has been in Nigeria for over 60 years, and it's had this damaging legal and environmental legacy for the company. But Shell has long been considered the most important energy producer in Nigeria. So its willingness to part with this investment also adds doubts to the country's future as an oil and gas producer. So that's, I think, a really interesting juxtaposition with this investment in the refinery, but some international shift in terms of investment in that space. Now, over the last decade, Nigeria's oil production has declined by about 40% because of lack of investment and management problems overall. So that's also one more piece of the puzzle in this kind of aging infrastructure and lack of investment in that. So what some are claiming is that Shell is selling now to try to avoid future responsibility for past actions. So Daniel Leader, who's a partner in the London-based law firm Lay Dai, which has represented Nigerian communities in cases against Shell, says Shell's selling now their decrepit infrastructure to local companies and leaving local communities in a state of environmental disaster. And Shell has stated that the new buyers will be accountable for the new subsidiary's share of, quote, commitments and remediation of any past spills. So this is really, I think, a very significant shift, a pulling out of responsibility. And as we see with these kinds of potential for real environmental and communal harm, that once the damage has been done, companies so often leave and you know, don't clean up what they had responsibility to take care of. So a lot of changing dynamics in Nigerian oil sector. And we, of course, when we think about Nigeria's politics and economy as a whole, oil plays such a large role. So we'll continue to think about how that shifts with this big commitment by domestic entities and less so potentially by international.
Agreed. And I want to point our listeners to a new book that was published by Indiana University Press that our friend and colleague, Ladia Dunby, wrote called Enclaves of Exception, Special Economic Zones and Extractive Practices in Nigeria. Longtime listeners may recall that Ladia was actually on this show long time ago. I can't remember if it was season one or two. Talking about his first book, the award-winning book, Oil Wealth and Insurgency in Nigeria. So this is a person who has a lot of deep field work, kind of understanding specifically the oil economy in Nigeria, but also the very local level experiences and politics of what's happening in these places of extraction and what that means for everyday people and their livelihoods. And the way they have to kind of navigate these corporate interests. So hopefully we'll be able to have Lottie on the show sometime in the next year to talk about this next book that he's published and what more our listeners can learn from it. Just on the topic of research, though, I want to point out a new article by our friends and co-authors, Clara Dita and Amanda Robinson. Now, they have this article was just published in the Quarterly Journal of Political Science, and it's trying to understand Black immigration to the United States and some of the existing arguments that have been made in political science and ethnic studies scholarship about how, in particular, Black immigrants face this kind of challenge, face a double challenge with their migration to the States, right? This country, which has a long history of anti-Blackness, and what does that mean for, in particular, African immigrants who are coming to the United States? And they have this really neat study that examines in particular the experiences of Somalis who have immigrated to the Midwest in the United States. It's an interesting study, and we hope our listeners will check it out, read it, let us know what you think about it, and maybe we could even have Claire and Amanda on the show as well.
I would love that for so many reasons. So one last thing that I want to alert our listeners to, particularly as we head into this year of 2024 and so many elections around the world that will be happening in really important places, important countries. And one of those is Ghana, headed towards 2024 polls. And in light of these upcoming elections, one of the headlines that we've seen is a worrying state of attacks on Ghana's press and freedom of the media in Ghana, in particular by political actors as well as by military actors. And so, I mean, Ghana's free expression and media vibrancy has been such a cornerstone of democratic practice and contestation over the last decades. And so this is a very worrying surge of attacks on journalists ahead of the 2024 elections. And the attacks range from physical assaults to intimidation to cyber threats and lawsuits. And that has really cast a shadow over the country's commitment to media freedom and democratic practice. Now, according to Ghana Journalists Association, there were a total of 45 documented cases of attacks against journalists in the media institutions from 2019 to 2023. And in particular, some very kind of highly acclaimed journalists have been putting out there the kinds of threats that they've been facing, particularly those who have been covering stories of traffickers and corruption, as well as different activities of high court judges. So there has yet to be any police activity. There have yet to be any arrests linked to these intimidation threats against the journalists. So really something to take to keep watching as we continue to monitor and root for democratic practice and vibrancy in Ghana.
Indeed, we'll be watching that closely, and tune in next week when Rachel and I will talk about the upcoming elections in Africa in 2024 and some things that we'll be watching in addition to closely following this contest in Ghana. And for now, let's turn to Paul Friesen.
Thank you, Rachel. And it's great to compare some of these cases together. So I've been working with Rachel on the Democratic Backsliding Project at Cornell for the last year and a half. We've been looking at these case studies, and we've seen, populism, polarization as key elements in a lot of democratic backsliding from different world regions. And something that we I think are still working on and interested in is what's happening at the local level. And so I'm going to focus on that today in a cross-country analysis and trying to understand how much of resilience do we see from kind of the local level, especially in the African context, where it's very, it can be very different depending on where you are. All right. And particularly, I want to start by having us think about the degree to which changes in the national regime reflect local practices. We might assume that these are closely tied, that as democratic backsliding occurs, that local democratic spaces are increasingly rare. But we also might think about, you know, other cases where there are kind of pockets of resilience or local leaders that have, that are responsive, that are able to deliver for people under their leadership. And this is also highlighting, I think it comes through especially powerful in the case of Tunisia, that a lot of parliament, MPs, to some degree, the local councillors being very non-representative of their populations. And we can see, I think, across regions, not just Africa, but other places as well, that there's a growing distrust, dislike for some of these democratic institutions, especially the ones that are very more abstract, more national, et cetera, that are often targeted by populist messages. In the specific case of most African countries, we have the role of traditional or indigenous leaders. And traditionally, of course, this has been overlooked or not. We haven't really been sure how to deal with this from a Western political science perspective. And of course, it raises interesting questions about definitions and the concept of democracy. But increasingly, I think there's really, you know, interesting work being done presently. And I'm going to focus on Afrobarometer data that has several questions that ask about traditional leaders in it, whether they're perceived to be democratic or not. And I think the evidence from just the descriptive data is overwhelming that they're more positive than negative to most people. And of course, we can go back, look at practices from up to hundreds and hundreds of years ago within specific communities and societies that there's a strong tradition of deliberative and consensus democracy within, you know, not all, but some groups and societies. So this gets at this question, are these local leaders, you know, kind of, we use the term captured brokers. Are they basically kind of the stooges of a autocratic national government, or are they fighting or at least being left alone from the national dynamics and can provide some pockets of resilience? And of course, I just want to, yeah, I've already mentioned this, but of course, variation in all of these things across all countries and regions within countries, et cetera, and between formal and non-formal types of governance. Just to give a little bit of descriptive data, I wanted to highlight our three case studies before I get into the main analysis. Just an overall evaluation, appreciation of leaders, that they have a good performance, that they're trustworthy, that they're not corrupt. And out of our three cases, it's traditional leaders in Malawi that take the top prize here. But also, and you'll see this in most analyses, that the positive views are traditional leaders and then local councillors and then MPs in that order. And this is actually the most even out of all of my analyses. Also in Benin, I think there's, you know, they have above average trust, positive performance for both types of local leaders. And then Tunisia is a little bit in the background with lower evaluations for all types of leaders. And I think this is, so this is overall just general performance. But when we look at, do these leaders listen to people? And the question wording is, how much of the time do you think the following leaders try their best to listen to what people like you have to say? And to me, this is a direct measurement of, you know, relating to eventual populism of nobody's listening to me, so I'm ready to vote whoever into office, whether they being an autocrat or whatnot. And here it's just a staggering difference between traditional leaders and formal leaders. And again, in this kind of tiered traditional leaders, then local councillors, then MPs. And this holds across in some of the analyses. I just take the top bottom countries on the VDEM Liberal Democracy Index, and I'm labeling them autocracies, though they obviously include hybrid regimes. So that's the autocracies are the bottom half of just the countries available in Afrobarometer, the democracies in the top half. And the thing that I just really I think is interesting. This is the overall, do traditional leaders listen to people, is exactly the same across any type of formal regime when we're looking at these national level institutions. So that should give us a hint that, you know, maybe there's something quite robust about especially traditional leaders and at the local level. So to investigate this further, this is just a so far an analysis. I don't have a whole paper, but I'm very excited about these round eight Afrobarometer questions, about 10 questions dealing with both the level of influence and whether you perceive traditional leaders to be behaving in a democratic fashion. And I'll use the same comparison of traditional leaders, local councilors, and MPs in the analysis. And basically, I'll go through the different outcomes here in the next few slides, but these estimates are including a couple dozen control variables, which are expected and pulled from the Afrobarometer, including partisanship, baseline views on democracy, local involvement, all the typical socioeconomic demographics, and self-censorship markers. And so the question I have at this, you know, at this point in the analysis is, are both traditional leaders and local councilors able to make a difference in people feeling like they're within it, living within a democratic space, even if just at the local level? And is it able to deliver on development and other sorts of well-being if we have leaders that are, you know, perceived to be more effective, democratically effective? So the first thing I really want to highlight here is that who gets contacted changes a lot, is both very different across the types of leaders and changes as the national level political institutions change. So here, this is on an index from 0 to 1, basically how often do you contact these leaders? And of course, MPs, fairly low. Of course, they have large constituencies to represent. And then local councilors in the middle, traditional leaders higher up. But the orange is the more autocratic leaning countries, and then the blue is the democratic leaning countries. And the contacting for these formal leaders, MPs and local councilors, decreases by about 15% if we just compare those two groups, but actually increases for contacting traditional leaders slightly in autocracies. So there it's maybe a little bit of a substitution effect of who you're going to seek help. And all these differences are statistically significant between the two groups of Afrobarometer countries. There's a range of, these interesting questions about traditional leaders. And so I use them to see how they influence whether you see your traditional leader as democratic, and saying that my leader is helping to strengthen democracy. And so here we should, if this is, you know, really pulling at, you know, something real underneath, that we should see that people are using the other criteria of about the local traditional leader, and that those are predicting whether they view the leader as democratic or not. So first one, saying that, yes, my leader serves the community, is the most powerful predictor for whether the leader is viewed as democratic, which of course makes sense. Not being corrupt is the second most important, that they're able to effectively do conflict management within the community, which of course is a key central role of many traditional leaders, that they listen to the people, that they're generally effective at governing. And there's some interesting differences between the more autocratic and democratic groups of countries, that serving the community becomes even more vitally important in the autocratic leaning countries, and things like, as well as being non-corrupt. And then there's this interesting disparity also with land management, that they don't want the traditional leaders doing land management in the autocratic countries, which I think is also intuitive. So I look at, from there, I'm looking at three main outcome variables. I want to know if the perceived extent of democracy changes if you have these effective local leaders. And here, basically, this is showing that if you have either a highly effective and democratic local councilor or a locally democratically effective traditional leader, that your perceived extent of democracy greatly increases. And I want to highlight that these are just among the autocratic leaning countries within the sample. So to me, this, I think this is a really exciting source of, despite what it, negative things that are happening at the national level, if I have one type of local leader that I know I can go to for help, that I'm feeling more satisfied and perceived in a greater extent of democracy. I'm also curious about just what service delivery, because we might expect that these leaders are providing better service delivery. And this is indeed the case. So having a high performing, just to give you a sense, I'm using the Live Poverty Index here. And again, just the autocratic leaning countries. So if you have a high performing traditional leader, it decreases by 1.6 points. If you have just a high performing local counselor, it's 1 point. And if you have both of those together, there's an interactive effect of dropping negative 4.4 points on the Live Poverty Index. So again, a stronger, effective local government is decreasing poverty through both of these measures. And we find a similar story in having access to health clinics in schools in the community, that both of, especially having one, but also both of these local leaders being democratic and effective is increasing the likelihood that you have both of these things in your community. And again, this is just within the more autocratic countries within the Afrobarometer sample. So to summarize very quickly, I see this continue, you know, very regular tiered level of traditional leaders, then local councilors, then MPs being the most effective, the most trusted, and the most likely to listen to me as a person. We see that, within more autocratic countries, the contacting rate for the formal leaders goes down, but actually goes slightly up for traditional leaders. That there's, I think some, you know, I think this has already been talked about, especially with Malawi, but there's, these are potential sources of resilience, no matter what's happening, I think at the local level or the national level, and might interact in some degree. But for Benin, they're also above average, both local councilors and traditional leaders on many of these measures. And then we see that having at least one of these local effective local leaders increases the perception of democracy for a person living in a more autocratic regime, and that both of these work towards decreasing poverty and autocratic regimes. So I was very interested in seeing, you know, comparing both the local counselors, the formal local, and then the non-formal traditional leaders, and them both having positive effects, kind of speaks to a complementary approach. So let me end it there.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamu Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMint, with help from production assistants Chukwufunanya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, and Ami Tamaklo. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.